Bonjour!
Comme ça, I'm Tink Laraval.
And I'm Dr. Catherine Wu, and you're listening to the Cultural Quotient Podcast.
In Season 1, we introduce the world to cultural intelligence, where it comes from and how it can help you with your cross-cultural relationships.
Now we are back for Season 2, where we share more stories and show you how CQ shows up in real life.
If you like what you hear, give us 5 stars or leave us a comment, question or feedback. We'll be happy to hear from you.
And now, enjoy the show!
Hello, everybody. Today we have a very special episode. It's actually our first time to have a guest on the show, and we're very, very excited. So we have today on the call Dr. Xiaoping, dialing in from Seattle. Catherine, what can you say about our guest?
Professor Xiaoping is a very dear guest, and I'm very, very happy to have her with us today. We met about 10 years ago in San Diego when we had our first cultural intelligence conference. I was a PhD student and you were already a big professor. Last year, when I visited Seattle, we had lunch together and it was amazing. The reason I contacted Xiaoping was because I had done the training for ICH, which is a tool that measures cross-cultural communication. So I wanted to learn more about the professors behind this work. And so today we have the great pleasure to have Professor Xiaoping Chen here with us from the University of Washington in Seattle.
Hi, Catherine. Hi, Ting. It's a great honor to be on your podcast.
Your story is quite interesting, and I remember very clearly that your story related to your personal interest in culture and cross-cultural communication. Do you want to share more about that?
Sure. So it's a long story, of course. You know, right. I grew up in China, and my hometown is in Hangzhou. And I had my elementary school, middle school, high school, and college in Hangzhou. And my major was in psychology. So from undergrad to a master's degree, then I went to University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, the psych department. And I did another master's degree in psychology and then a PhD. My major was social and industrial psychology. After graduation, I went to Hong Kong University of Science and Technology as assistant professor in the management department. When I was a doctoral student, my research interested in groups and teams, and I'm also interested in cross-cultural psychology. Harry Trandis, who is a guru in cultural psychology, was one of my advisors. I took his class, and we did projects together. But I wasn't so serious about doing cross-cultural work until I arrived in Hong Kong. Then Harry Trandis contacted me to collect some data about a cross-cultural negotiation. So I said, sure, I can do that. So we did the study of how to measure a person's orientation in terms of individualism, collectivism, to include the horizontal and also the vertical dimension.
Sorry to interrupt, but you have to explain that to me later. What is horizontal and what is vertical in this context of cultural dimensions, but carry on.
So we started from there. Then I started to think, hey, I've been in the States for 5+ years. I grew up in China. Now I'm in Hong Kong. I have real insights into these cultures because I was sort of insider in each of these. And so from that, I become serious in studying cross-cultural issues in the workplace. Another thing that made me particularly interested in cross-cultural communication is my own experience. So when I first went to the U.S., although I had high scores on all the written exams of English, I never spoke to a real foreigner when I was in China. So you can imagine, I couldn't really talk to people. I could listen and comprehend, but it was very, very difficult for me to speak. So I didn't really talk for maybe about 2 years. I didn't realize how that actually influenced people's perception of me until one day I felt confident to talk, right? I think it plays such an important piece, especially in the U.S. culture. When you don't talk, people don't know you at all. They do not really pay attention to the nonverbal cues that you were exhibiting, nodding or, you know, very friendly kind of a demeanor. you need to talk to let people know you. Recently, we did a study, which is fascinating, and it's completely about communication style. Very, very simply, you're an indirect communicator or direct communicator. And we find that people in the US, when we ask them to describe an indirect communicator, they use mostly negative words about the person. My goodness. But when you tell them this person is a very direct communicator, they will associate with that person all kinds of positive words. So, of course, at the time, I didn't realize that. Anyway, so I started my journey on the cross-cultural research. After 3 years in Hong Kong, I came back to the States. At that time, my sister was working for Microsoft. And she said, hey, why don't you come here? You know, it's such a beautiful place. It has great lakes and mountains, just like our hometown, right? So I came in the summertime, which is beautiful every day, cool temperature, sunshine. I said, sure, I will look for a job here. So I applied, interviewed, and I moved here since. That was 1999. Wow.
24 years in Seattle. So you are an American now. How is your communication?
So it's a long journey, right? And after 20, 30 years, I feel very, very comfortable living here in Seattle. And I feel more comfortable communicating, sharing my personal thoughts.
Right? Thank you, Xiaoping. I was wondering if we could go back to what you said about horizontal dimension of culture versus vertical. So since starting this show, I've become less ignorant about concepts on cultural intelligence. So our very first episode was on the different cultural dimensions according to Hofstadter, right? And you mentioned just now about looking at individualism from a horizontal versus vertical point of view. So could you expand on that a little bit more? What do we mean when we say horizontal versus vertical dimension?
When we talk about individualistic orientation, that means that people emphasize their own self-interest and self-goals. And people who are collectivistic oriented, they emphasize group goals, group interests, and group harmony. When another dimension is added, the horizontal and the vertical one, means that for a person who just tries to maximize his or her personal interests or profits or goals, but doesn't care whether they do much better or worse than other people, these are horizontal individualists. The vertical individualists, they also want to see how much better I am than other people. So that's the vertical dimension. It's like this competition kind of mindset. So we found that the Chinese people in mainland China, their vertical individualism scored much higher than people in the US and people in Australia. Wow. Although the horizontal individualism, okay, the US people and Australian people scored much higher than the Chinese people. But the vertical individualism, which means that the Chinese people are much more sensitive to how better they do than other people or how worse they do. And they are always comparing, you know, themselves with other people to sort of decide whether they feel a sense of achievement or not.
So what you say means that there is more social comparison.
That's right. That's right.
And how does that fit within the collectivist dimension? Because we know China as a very collectivistic society as well.
Yes. So the Chinese collectivism, I think according to my observation, is also more on the vertical side, which means that they want their country or their group better than other countries or better than other groups, rather than just, okay, let's do it together and try our best to achieve our goals. Not only our goals, but we need to make sure we are better than other groups so that we have this feeling of maybe superiority or something like that.
So what I'm hearing from you, just overall, they're more competitive. It sounds like.
Exactly. Yes, yes. They're more competitive and the social comparison process is more pervasive in the Chinese society than at least in the US or Australia or Canada.
This is an interesting question that Catherine asked, vertical individualism vis-a-vis vertical collectivism. And when hearing you describe it, and then if you watch the news, hear about how China is doing now in the world overall, economically, militarily, all these things, even the Olympics, now it makes sense. These traits are what's fueling the rise of China as a new superpower.
Xiaoping, I want to follow up on this. In preparation for this interview, I was going through all your research and publications, and you did a lot of work on cooperation.
My research is how to induce people to cooperate in a situation where there is this conflict between maximizing individual interests and maximizing collective interest. And that is a research area called social dilemma research. Three people come to my lab, I give each of you $100. And then I say, you can invest your money into one of two accounts. Okay, one account is your personal account, and another account is the group account. If you invest your money into your personal account, that money is yours, but there's no interest. But if you invest your money into the group account, I will give you double the value. Your money will earn 100% interest. At the end, this money in the group account will be distributed equally among all members. So you need to decide how much money to give to the group account, right? So the ideal situation, of course, we say, if we all put our $100 into the group account, at the end, everyone gets $200 and we leave the lab. Okay, that's great. Another thinking is that, no, I'm not going to put in the group account. I will keep in my personal account. But I hope that other people will put them into the group account, right? Mm-hmm. So I keep my $100. You too put your $200 into the account, which become $400. And the $400 divided by three is 133, something like that. So at the end, you get 133, but I get 233. So in that situation, people have this temptation to free ride. And another situation is like, okay, we're all so smart, right? None of us will put any money into the group account. Then at the end, we all just got $100. Okay. Now you think about this. What should you do in this situation, right? So obviously, if everyone contributes their all money, the outcome is much better than if no one contributes any money to the group account. Mm. Okay. Mm. However, the dilemma is that when you do not contribute, but other people do, you are much better off than other people, right? So that means when you contribute less, you always get more for yourself comparing with when you contribute more. So that's the dilemma. So the dilemma is for your personal interest or the individual rationality is not to contribute at all. And then from the collective rationality that people should all contribute to the group account. So the individual rationality and group rationality, they are in conflict. That's why we call this a social dilemma. And it actually resembles a lot of real life situations.
I was just going to say, like, paying your social security, taxes, like everything, right?
Or even this global warming thing, right? It's all related to this particular dilemma. All right. So I was fascinated about this and I wanted to find out, like, what can we do to make people more willing to contribute to the group account than to keep money in their personal account? So, of course, as you can imagine, the economists are all over it, right?
Yeah.
And they will create all kind of incentives and change the structure of the society, the interests, distribution and all these things to overcome this problem. But as a psychologist, we think we have cheaper ways of doing this. That is, you need to really induce people to feel that actually you are completely connected with the collective. If the collective fails, everyone will fail. You know, like the global warming situation. It's so real today, right? Because we all contributed somehow to this global warming. Then if we didn't do it, we are still become a victim of this terrible situation. So no one can actually avoid the disastrous outcome if we don't do anything. So we did a lot of experiment to find out ways to help people become more willing to contribute. And the one magical solution is communication. It's communication. It's just like, I say it's magic, because once we do the experiment, like we have half of the subjects, we put them into the situation and they need to make a decision, right? How much money? We give them real money and how much to contribute. And we do not allow them to communicate with each other. So that's one experimental condition. And another experimental condition, we give you just 8 minutes to discuss before you make your private anonymous decision. Just this 8 minutes works magic. So at the end, we found that with communication, at least like 70% of the people in the experiment would contribute their money to the group account. But without communication, only anywhere between 10% to 30% of people would contribute. So the 10% are the subjects from the economist departments. And the 30% are the subjects from the psychology department. But then you compare the two percentages, it's a huge difference. And all you do is to allow people to communicate. And they talk about what's the pros and the cons, right? What would happen if we do this or if we do that? So the communication is the magical remedy.
So what does communication do that shifts people's mind?
So we actually studied that as well. So what happened during this communication and discussion that made people change their mind? And one thing is that people need to figure out what this dilemma actually is. Because sometimes it's very complex, right? Like, how do I know how much I should contribute to the group account? But after discussion, people have a better understanding of the nature of this dilemma. They realize if we all contribute, we're all better off at the end, you know. And the people who are willing to contribute, they will say, hey, if we all contribute, we are, of course, better off. And for me, I'm willing to contribute. I will put all this money into the group account. And it's up to you guys if you want to do this or not. And then once someone starts to say that, and people would feel, at least I can trust someone in the group. It seems that people in my group are not so selfish. They actually think about other people's interests and the group interests. So just over these several minutes, the members will feel sort of a norm in their group that, yes, we should all contribute. So here I said, regardless of how much you contribute to the group account, your money will be doubled in value than distributed. But another type of game could be like, hey, we have four people in this team and the instruction says we need three people to contribute to reach this amount. So obviously, it does not need all four people's contribution, right? So how about this? Like, you keep your $100. We three contribute to the account. And then we get $200 bonus. Of course, you can invite us for dinner, but you will actually have $300 when we finish the experiment. We all get $200. Which means they will sort of make a promise to each other. We three will contribute. You just keep your money, okay? But then we ask them to make their individual anonymous decision, which means they can change their mind at that point because nobody else would know. Only the experiment would know, right? However, nobody changed their mind. That means that people who made a promise to contribute to the group account, they all stick to their promise. So we try to find out why is that the case. Yeah. We actually recorded all their discussions and conversations, and we found that because they felt they were so critical in helping the team to reach its goal. And if now I back off, I say, hey, I'm not going to contribute, then I know my team probably won't succeed without my contribution. So this perceived criticality in this communication process that people felt about the importance of their own contribution actually made a big difference in terms of whether they actually would contribute to the group account or not. Yeah, so because of communication, a lot of psychological feelings were aroused. And it's these psychological feelings that could sustain their contribution later on.
That's such a fascinating experiment. What do you think, Catherine?
I like to bring it back to the original topic of cross-cultural communication, because you are an expert in cross-cultural communication. Many people in the cross-cultural space know about direct and indirect communication, Edward Hall, on high and low context. And I remember reading in your paper that for so long, people knew about it, but nobody was measuring it. That's where you started that work on context and context dependence. Do you want to tell us a bit more about this?
So the context of communication, that notion has been around for a long, long time since Edward Hall's book Beyond Culture was published. And a lot of scholars have been doing research on this construct. But the construct itself is sort of vaguely defined because it says it's about to the extent to which people use explicit coded message in communicating a meaning. But what do you mean by this context thing? So one year, Nancy, Wendy, and I, we were attending a workshop at Duke University, and they invited Richard Lewis, who can speak more than 10 languages. He lives in England, in the UK, and he has his own consulting company all about intercultural communication, because he's so fluent in so many different languages, understood culture really, really well, published several papers, and had his own tool of measuring different communication style. So we thought the tool that he uses is interesting. But when we look at the items, we thought, no, this is really bad. Because his item is like, do you talk directly to other people? Yes or no. Do you use stories to convey a message? Yes or no. So that is completely not the scientific way of developing a tool. So starting from there, that we read all Edward Hall's book. When we read all these books, we thought, oh my God, actually the context of communication includes more than just direct or indirect. So we thought, yeah, we can actually develop a more rich understanding of this context notion. Anyway, so we have this message style, the space domain, then the relationship domain, and the time domain. And all this is related to how people communicate with each other and how people interact with each other. The style itself includes four domains of context: message, relationship, time, and space. So the message style is relatively simple. It's like when you deliver a message, whether you are direct or indirect, explicit or implicit, and when you interpret a message, to what extent you can detect the hidden meanings, right, are embedded in the message itself. So the interpretation, the expression, and then the message style related to interaction is the conflict management style. Whether when we encounter conflict, we try to just deal with it directly or we avoid it. When we have disagreement, do we just say it aloud or we cover it with other things, right? So that's the message style. Then the relationship domain of communication context, that is like to what extent I pay attention to the relationship factor in my communication. Whether this person has a higher status than me, do I communicate the same way I talk to my subordinate or the older person, a young child, or to someone that I have very close relationship or a distant relationship? Do I change my demeanor or change my word in accommodating that? And some people don't care about who they're talking with, right? They just say whatever on their mind. But some people, they are very sensitive to that piece. So that's the relationship context in communication. And the time domain is that to what extent we sort of rely on time to convey meaning, or when we interpret something that using time, like it has something to do with time, we understand it in a different way. So for example, When I talk to you guys, I often just look at my watch. It means like there's some meaning there, right? Or when I need to meet with you guys in person and we said, okay, it's like 2 o'clock and I arrive 10 minutes before 2 and your secretary say, hey, can you wait? Catherine is busy, Ting is busy. I said, no problem. Then it's 2, you're still busy and you ask me to wait for another 15 minutes versus half an hour versus an hour. I will read something from that, right? Yeah. So the time conveys meaning. So the space domain is most common that we all understand. That's the nonverbal cues that we convey through the space, like how distant we stand from each other, right? To what extent I look at you when I speak to you, do I touch you, do I hug you when we meet, and what kind of voice and tone and pitch and overlap or interruption or silence, these are all related to the space context. So the context of communication are actually the cues that is surrounding a message. They're not message itself, but they are all the things that surrounding a message that actually convey meaning to others. And that's why we say communication style itself is so important, because research has found that 65% of the meanings are actually embedded in the nonverbal cues, not in the message itself, right? So I can say the same thing, but when I use a different tone, a different expression, it could mean completely different things.
Thanks for explaining that. So just on the time thing, right? I recently saw this movie where the time message was a huge factor. So you know how sometimes in high power meetings, the person that you need to sell to or whose buy-in you need is very, very critical. And therefore, as the CEO of the company, you have to show up late because we're telling him that you're a super busy man. If you show up on time or if you show up early, then that'll say that maybe you're not so busy after all. So just come a few minutes late and tell them, oh, I was in another meeting, but I got pulled out because I didn't want to miss. And that also conveys that you are so important to me and my team. So to me, that just concretized that aspect of communicating through time.
Yeah. However, people in different cultures would understand it or interpret it in very different ways. In many of the Eastern, like in Asian countries, they would feel, of course, leaders are busy and they're a few minutes late, that's totally fine. But if you go to Switzerland or Germany or even Japan, people would view you very negatively because you are not even time conscious. You cannot keep the time. That's a very bad trait. So same behavior, but the interpretation could be very different depending on where you live and what's the social norm. In the US, mostly people feel that no matter how big a leader you are, you should be on time. And many good leaders actually arrive before the scheduled time. So just recently, I invited the VP of Costco, who is actually in charge of all international expansions beyond North America. He opened every store of Costco outside of North America, in Japan, in Europe, in China, in Taiwan, South Korea. When I invited him to come to my class, he's always early. And he always wanted to make sure everything works a day before the class started. So that kind of conscientiousness, these are great leaders to me. They embody what they actually preach. One time when I was in China, it was a big conference and they invited the vice president of the university to give a few remarks at the beginning. And she was late and we were all just waiting for her. I was like, oh my God, this is horrible, you know? And so later when it was my turn to speak, I actually joked about that. Maybe that really pissed them off. So, huh, you have a higher status than us. Like, so many people are just waiting for you. And you're 15 minutes late. We were just sitting there, you know? Very bad impression in my mind.
So Ting did the survey and she got the report to understand her communication styles.
Excellent. So this is actually just the first step. You got your profile, right? And you look at this and say, hey, how true it actually reflects my communication style. So one important thing when we talk about communication style is that there's no good or bad communication style. And then you look at your own profile and say, oh, yeah. Now, team, so for you, on three domains, right? Relationship, message, and space. It's all sort of moderate to high. Moderate means that you are somewhere in between two extremes, which means if you work in a team, you can act as a bridge person because you understand both sides, which is a great position to be. But then, of course, when I look at your level three results, I can see, oh, although the mean of that particular dimension is in the middle, but on some questions, you're on this extreme and that one is on the other side. So for example, on the message domain, you can recognize the hidden meanings and other people's emotions. So you score pretty high on these two, which means you are very sensitive. You actually pay attention to other people's nonverbal cues in communication, which is great. And then on the conflict avoidance or conflict management style, it's a very interesting. You're not afraid of conflict. You know, you're okay with it. However, for disagreement, you are reluctant to express your
disagreement. That is one of the things I wanted to ask you. Is like, it seems like they're saying opposite things. Yeah.
Yeah, it seems that way. But this means that in your heart, you know, conflict is not a horrible thing, right? You can deal with conflict. But meanwhile, you don't like to do it in a way sort of confrontational. So you say, hey, no, you're wrong. But you will try to maintain other people's faith in solving the conflict. So they're not contradictory to each other. So you do not express your disagreement directly, but you do it in a way that makes people feel comfortable and you do not hurt their feelings when you do it. But you are not afraid of conflict.
Yeah, because I'm just a nice person all around. You know?
Exactly. When I look at your profile, yes, I feel like I definitely love this person, you know?
Wow.
And you also, because later, like on the sensory style, you know, you like to have eye contact, right? And more like a dramatic expression, which makes the things like very live and interesting.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, you do not interrupt other people, right? So when we talk about like Latin American people, they are very expressive, you know, a lot of emotions and so on, but they also interrupt each other to show that they are interested in each other's talk.
They're engaged.
It's not rude. But as you can imagine, in the States, if you interrupt other people, people say, hey, you are so rude. Like, you should wait till I finish. So that's the same behavior, very different interpretations. Okay, so when you look at your communication style, you have some kind of self-awareness, which I noticed that on the time dimension, you're extremely low context, which means like you pay attention to deadlines, you pay attention to the schedules, the task structure is all important to you. So it's a very professional, let's get to the task and let's get it done, very organized. When I look at Teen's profile, she's just an average American manager.
Definitely. Yeah. That's the Singapore effect on me. Because yes. In this country, everything is pretty much on time and works like clockwork, as Catherine can attest to.
Yes.
This country is known for its efficiency. And one reason why that is because everybody respects and values time very much. So that's definitely the Singapore effect on me.
Excellent. So this is just like one function. But the most useful for this tool is when you compare your communication style with your team members. At that time, you will see, oh, how different I am, for example, on this particular dimension than other members. And you would see, of course, to what extent people converge on one dimension, and sometimes it's a huge variance along another dimension. So for example, I have project teams for my class, right? And I purposely put people from different cultural backgrounds together to let them experience the frustration in a safe environment. But I want them to have a good experience, even though with different people from different cultures. By doing this exercise, it helps a great deal for them to understand each other's communication style on these four domains, now, especially like one is conflict management style. Oftentimes, a group will vary a great deal on this dimension. Some people are completely okay with conflict. Some people are like so afraid of conflict. Some people are somewhere in between. So when you have a team like that, how do you figure out how you handle conflict, right? Because some people would never talk about it. They try to hide it or try to not to mention it. But some people just like, hey, this is wrong. Just point out directly. And that would hurt these high context people. See, how do you do that? So aggressive. You just point out like, I did this wrong and so on. So how do you reconcile these differences and work together as an effective team? So the first time discussion, like before any task starts, let's talk about our communication style and say, oh my God, we are very, very different here. How are we going to do this? All right. And some teams are very constructive. They say, okay, so person A, he is not afraid of conflict, right? And our person five, I'm very afraid of conflict. I will never say anything. So how about this? If there's a conflict, we do need to solve the conflict, right? So I don't want to talk about it, but that person is not afraid. So how about this? Every time we just designate this person to point out all the issues and problems within our team. And it's not like this person has a terrible sort of demeanor. It's that he's more natural in talking about these issues. So he point out these issues and then we start to chime in to discuss solutions. So let's do that. All right. So once they figure that out and next time when there's an issue, they follow this process. So that's like one particular thing. And in the time thing, actually, you also see that some people, you know, like to talk about personal things during a group meeting, right? And some people say, no, let's get to the task immediately. It's like, we shouldn't waste any time. So how do you reconcile that? And once you find, okay, we have a huge variation here among our team members, we need to figure out the best way. And everyone would feel comfortable. So for some teams, they will come up with this, like, okay, we don't care about your personal stuff. Let's not talk about personal things at all, okay, in our team meeting. After our team meeting, maybe some of you are okay with this. You guys do it, you know, privately. But other teams say, actually, building social relationships is important. So talking about personal issues is actually a good way to start our meeting. So how about we spend the first 5 to 10 minutes just go around to talk about personal things?
I have a good example of that. I have daily calls with my project team. Usually when we have a lot of things to talk about, then we jump straight into business. However, typically on Monday or Friday, we spend at least the first opening minutes asking, oh, how was your weekend? What did you do? And then on Friday, we'll ask, oh, so what's your plan this weekend? You know, to establish that social connection that you're talking about. Because at least for me, I think it was in my report, that's something I value.
Yes,
I work better with people when I can establish some kind of personal connection with them.
So interestingly, you know, when I compare these teams, right? So some teams say they don't talk about personal issues. Then other teams, they do that. And they actually have like question of the day. And you talk about personal things. And these teams, at the end, they become friends. And the just task-focused teams, after class, they are just doing their own thing. They no longer would be in contact. So just these like 5 minutes makes a difference.
yeah. And otherwise, it's so transactional, right? We're just here to get this done. Mm-hmm. I'm a consultant, so we go from project to project. And obviously, the team changes depending on the project. A few projects ago, which is where we started this practice of checking in and talking about weekend stuff. Mm. Now when we see each other, I mean, obviously, aside from the bonding that we developed during the course of that project, because it was such a brutal, demanding, long hours, blood, sweat, and tears kind of process, so that already bonds you. But then now when you see them, you're not, oh, so how are your orchids doing? Because back then, they had talked about trying to raise orchids. Right. And so you're right. I mean, we're not friends, but there's still that personal connection.
So the value of this instrument is that when you compare yours with your team members, and then you identify the similarities and differences, And for similarity, it's relatively easy to deal with, right? Yeah, like, you know, we interpret things similarly. We can read hidden meanings. I can tell from someone's facial expression whether he's or she's happy or not. But the differences are the areas that will help you to develop a strategy to how to deal with it before you engage in your task. We call this a team contract. And once you have that, and later on, you actually encounter that problem, you're not at a loss.
So I have a question on this, Xiaoping, because obviously not everybody will have the opportunity to do an assessment before you start working with some people. Maybe could you give us some simple tips or strategies that I can apply or that our listeners can apply just to gauge like, this person might be this communication style or that communication style without having to answer a survey?
So normally when you have an instrument, it looks more objective, right? There's some kind of number that you can look at. The IC Edge survey itself is quite long because it has more than 90 questions. But we do have a short form, less than 20 questions. It also touches upon the four domains of communication context. And that is available in our paper, actually. So you can just do this like really quickly and you can tell whether you are generally a direct person, indirect person, right? You pay attention to relationship or not, and the time, whether this is you are more monochronic or polychronic. So that could be a very quick tool to use. The good thing is that when we discuss each other's communication style, we might talk about our background, personal background, like why I'm such an indirect person, because my parents always teach me not to confront with other people, you know, especially those important people. Even though you disagree, you should just keep it to yourself. Like how you were brought up, right? How you were socialized, or oftentimes you observe that people who are too direct, they get punished, you know, things like that. So that I need to be careful not to say things too bluntly. And then we start to talk about our personal stories and people have a deeper understanding of each other. That's actually the more important piece. And that's how we appreciate each other more, or at least understand where you come from, right? Mm-hmm. And this anchor is relatively non-political, right? The communication style, no good or bad, and everyone has one.
I have one last comment and then I will pass back to Catherine because I think she's itching with a couple of questions and comments. I can tell from her nonverbal cue from her face. Right. One of the biggest questions I had also when taking this was, in this era of virtual calls and Zooms and not being there face to face, especially if video is not on, which is a lot of the time what happens in my calls. We don't have any videos on and it's just voice. How does that show up in reports like this? Does that actually have an influence? Because I think it influenced my results. Like when it said that I exaggerate words or I'm more expressive, part of that is because I feel I need to paint a picture with my words. And then the other one is simply, you know, sometimes also because of my face, if I have my video on, I've been told in the past, I have a Lehi face, like in Chinese, very kind of stern looking. So I kind of soften myself and make myself seem more accessible and approachable by injecting humor, by exaggerating, things like this, because I feel like that'll also get my message across better. So in the world of virtual calls and no cameras and no context verbal cues, I wonder how that shows up in the report.
Actually, I do have some research findings to share with you, Ting, regarding that. So first, in the virtual setting, right, when we do have videos, paying attention to people's nonverbal cues is super important in helping building relationships among team members. The second piece is engaged listening. That's why I always wear my earphone. So you hear all the, the micro sort of, you know, tones and pitch and all these things. So these two are very important. The third dimension, which is appearing professional on screen, that factor was not a significant factor in terms of building relationships. So relax, it's okay. Just wearing casual things. Now, when there's no video, we did this study with the undergrad students at San Diego University. It's all virtual, classroom, okay? But they need to do teamwork, and it's up to them whether they use video or not. And we found that majority of groups actually did not use video at all, you know? And then we compare their performance in class in terms of different dimensions like group identity, psychological safety, you know, all these things, versus the teams that sometimes actually use video. Significant difference. Using video helps a great deal in all important team outcome variables. So if you have the tool, right, why not using it? If possible, use as much video as possible.
This is great. Thank you so much, Xiaoping, for sharing all this very insightful findings and experiences. I think now it's time to come to an ending of this podcast. But before we close, for our listeners who are interested to find out more about this work on cross-cultural communication, the survey, the reports that Ting did, where can people go?
Oh, yeah. So we actually have a training. So it's two consecutive sessions for people who want to use this tool and be able to explain what are the meaning of the scores and so on and so forth. If you're interested, you can email support@icedge.com. It's free to everyone.
So yes. This is a training for people who want to learn how to use the tool and maybe want to use it in their work. Okay.
Yes.
Is there more information on your website?
So you can go to the website, icedge.com.
Wonderful.
Catherine has called the time, and in the interest of staying true to my survey results, wherein time is something I try to adhere to as much as possible, I just want to thank Xiaoping for joining us today. It was a real privilege. I wish we had another session because there's so many more things we can unpack about the tool, about your experiences, about some of the other insights you have generated over the years. I'm sure we can arrange something in the future. But in the meantime, thank you so much for joining us. And thank you for another interesting conversation, Catherine. And to our listeners, thank you so much and have a nice day ahead.
Thank you for listening.
Remember to give us 5 stars or leave a comment, question, or feedback on LinkedIn.
Till next time.